I'll be back where Bruce McLeod, and with me is
Trish Coo.
And this is Testcast show number 2. We managed to get through the first one and get out the door. And this is show number 2 where we're going to go down the... Well, what should we talk about, Trish? Well, let's cover off... We can talk about the way it's a whole given-then-when spec flow, and I can also...
Yeah, some BDD.
And why don't I give the merry history of my test automation past and why Excel just doesn't work.
Yeah, gosh, I can't wait for that.
Plus, hey, I don't know, recording playback, we can talk about that too.
Yeah, good idea.
Behavior-driven design is a whole interesting. So when we talk about behavior-driven design, so you first were the one first pointed me at this, Trish. I've always viewed there's two styles of testing. There's the, as I refer to them, I've got a blog post about this again, which I'll link to, what I refer to as my mum and dad. So this is test cases written to a minute level of detail that you require no business knowledge. So, for example, if it was me testing campaign monitor, it would be, don't know anything about the system, it would be step one, click on the start button.
Yeah.
Expect actual result, start button, menu opens, tick. Step two, on a Mac file. That sort of thing.
Right, so anybody can just come into your project and use it.
You give it 21, and so you're talking about reams and reams and reams of documents. So, I refer to that as mom and dad approach. The other extreme is what I refer to as the post-it note, which is the tester is an absolute domain expert. You trust them implicitly, both from their testing and domain skill. If they say it's done, it's done. So they can essentially write on a post-it note and go, it's tested.
Yeah.
And you'll ship it based on that. So there is like the two extremes. The reality is somewhere in the middle. So the sort of the middle ground that I've sort of normally gone towards would be... And it's interesting what I found is when I'm doing automation and you're writing test cases, you subconsciously tend to write the test cases with automation in mind.
Yeah, that does happen.
So what I found is my test case writing style became to write very simple atomic test cases in a couple of lines. So in my group example, verify that you can check out purchasing a book. Mm-hmm. That would be the test case. It's literally two lines. There's an assumed level of domain knowledge. Okay, you have to know how the checkout process works, you have to know what the system is. But then there's a number of criteria that I would apply. Can anyone on the test team with a certain level of knowledge apply another test and do the same, get the same result? So is it repeatable? Would it pass an audit? So if you had an external audit and you want to say this is what we've run, would it be able to pass through that? And is there the least effort to maintain it as possible? So that's the normal thing that I would use and have been preaching. And then you mentioned the given when then?
Yeah.
So what is this given when then? Explain it to me.
it's a format for writing test cases in more of a plain English kind of way. So the idea is you'll have a statement such as, given that I am a user, when I click the login button, then I should be logged into the application. So it's the given gives you the context. I'm a user of this application, as in maybe I'm not an admin or a support person or whatever. Then there's the when, which is the trigger for the scenario. So when I click some kind of button that triggers some kind of action. And then there's then, which is the expected result. So it's putting it in a language that is consistent, that everybody can understand. And so it's something that you can sit down and write with your business analysts, with even your end users, and everybody from your end users through to your developers can understand the same thing. But it's giving you exactly the information you want in terms of context, trigger, and expected result.
So the question I have about that is, does it scale? So,
what way?
Okay, so you've just given a classic example of, I do action, I click on a button, I get a result.
Mm.
Does it scale to, I have large system X, and it's going to give a data feed into system B, that then is going to, a batch job is then going to run, and these accounts, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
the large...
I know what you mean. It is a bit oversimplified. And occasionally I have been writing things more along the lines of given when, then, when, then, when, then.
So, is that better? Do you think... Obviously, it's constrained in the syntax.
It depends on what you're doing, really. If you use it and you find that it's working for you, then it's good. If you use it and you're finding that you need a more complicated language than that, then maybe given when, then is not for you.
So, the other question I have is... So you're familiar with gherkin, cucumber? So gherkin is the... Okay, so the cucumber ninja scrolls is the...
Gherkin is the BDD...
Language
on top of cucumber.
Okay, one or the other.
Let's look it up.
Let's look it up. So we're correct. We're going to steer people down the farm track. Cucumber is the execution engine in a Reeves files in the Gherkin format. So Gherkin is the language, the Hebrew is the format.
Right.
So Gherkin is the syntax, the given when then syntax, and Cucumber is the execution engine. Then there's Specflow, which is another execution engine. And
basically logical.
Yes, so Specflow is the .NET implementation. That's one that I've used in particular. So... have you played with using these techniques to drive your automation?
I have. I used Specflow to drive my automation, which is written in C# using WebEye. And I thought it was quite good. It was still a fair bit of work, I've got to say, to write the automated tests. But the advantage was that on the top level, it was really easy to read.
So... yeah, so I'll go into automation stack design. It's a whole 3 or 4 hours to go through in proper detail. What I found is, just to cover it at a high level though, what I found is that if you have a stack which has your nice logical separation of your test cases in a business domain, it would work for that model really, really well. I think if you're doing more traditional automation where everything is mixed up, you'd really struggle to do a figure automation in particular.
Yeah, the thing was that I already had an existing stack that was more of a traditional type of design, so trying to put that extra layer on top of that, of course, was going to be a lot of work. I found also that when you're writing the test cases and the BDD style at the top, you tend to want to reuse a lot of it, so that kind of limits the way you write it. So if you want to say when the user logs in, then you'll want to use that exact same wording in every other test case. You don't really get that free kind of style of writing your test cases anymore because you're trying to reuse all of your sentences all the time.
Because the way that technology works is essentially regular expression matching. So it does a regular expression matching. Mm. Takes the first part, that becomes the method, and the second part becomes the parameter.
Right.
So what I've sort of found interesting, though, is I think this is a really exciting take on an approach to testing test automation. So for me, what I found really interesting is that I'd say this is a real bleeding edge way of thinking. So yes, test-driven development using an N unit or an R unit or a J unit style of you have a method with attributes and you have a runner that runs it. Yes, that was great 10 years ago. And this is really interesting state of the art. But what I find interesting is if you think of this as one of a number of techniques that people try to do to bring order to their supposedly automated testing tools.
Hmm.
So one of the big things, one of the big ticket items that you see, that you hear about with one of my testing tools, when I first started doing it with it way back in 98, whatever it was, when you first have a test automation, one of the first things that a vendor will tell you is, look, I can just record your actions and play it back. Yeah. And you go, wow, that's cool. Where do I sign up? And for small testing, it may actually still have value. So in that scenario with that original company, we had a very simple client product doing managing a workflow. That product, or say simple, it was simple at the time, but definitely seems simple now. So it's a very simple product, but that product was deployed on 4 different Unix backends, and from a client point of view, we would test on, back in the day, it was Windows 95, it was Windows NT 3.5.1, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe NT4, Citrix. And then you had, because we used some client pieces, it was what versions of, you know, Visual Basic runtime were installed. So you have all these client things that you had to deal with. And
yeah.
For us, our test matrix, we essentially had 5 client platforms we had to test. For us to test those client platforms, being able to automate that instantly went from what I used to take me 5 days to do with 5 manual testers, I could now do in 1 day with one automator. So straight away there was a straight out, you could see the savings of, and just I'll hear what I'm saying here in a second. I could take my one test case or one suite of test cases, and it was literally probably about 15 tests, that would take someone all day to run. So instead of having taken a week to do that, so I could execute, I think, 50 tests or 40 tests in a day. And that was, oh my God, I can execute 50 tests in a day.
Wow.
Right? Which is...
it's like some kind of silver bullet.
But it's nothing. Right? down the track, you know, little did I know that I'll be running 1,200 tests a day on some web-based projects than more recently. But yes, that would be, even still, even though it was only... still only running 50 tests a day. You could see straight away, we've now managed to, these 4 testers that we would have doing this test run over the week, and we can now do that in this time. So even though, yes, it's record and playback, and yes, it wasn't maintainable, there was a straight dollar saving that justified buying the tool.
Yeah.
And that's the thing was, we run, and that was rational. It was whatever Rational's product was.
Robot.
Rational Robot, that's it. Hey, you remember. It's that Rational Robot. Yeah, and so we had it. We hired a consultant in to build a stack and, you know, all sort of stuff. So all sold on pretty much record and playback. But there was a gain there. But what I've seen is for big, when you start talking about realistic intents, that wasn't realistic. We did that. So I finished the story. We did that. I then got headhunted out, left. My replacement came in and went, automation? What's that? No, I don't get automation because I think it came from game testing or something. Stop the automation, turned it off, box goes up on the shelf, the money that was invested, even though it was a definite cost gain, became shelf worth. So I think, to me, that is, I just have this vision of, that I think a lot, you know, I don't know the exact number, I can guess. I'm guessing 30% or more, particularly of older tool sales, were bought, tried, failed on the shelf. So literally, shelfware sold on the promise of record and playback.
Yeah.
So given that record and playback doesn't work, people try other approaches, right? So then one of the next classic ones, and I think I've tried mostly myself, spreadsheet generations.
Ah, yes.
So the theory, did that?
Is this the test-driven, what is it, data-driven development?
Oh, okay, so yes and no. So data-driven testing, particularly in the...
data-driven testing.
Data-driven testing, there's a few terminologies which are definitely the Mercury terminologies.
Yes.
AUT, so application of the test, is very much a Mercury terminology. Data-driven testing is another one which sort of came from there. So a data-driven test in WinRunner was where you take a normal test and you would fire the little data-driven wizard and you would highlight a section of code and you would go next, 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 and it would essentially give you a little Excel table.
Yeah.
that would then drive parameters in the test and would run through five times from that data table. That's what the data driven driving was. So I'm not talking about, so people do this coding, right? Writing code is expensive. How can we stop this writing code? Record and playback is one way. The other way is spreadsheets. So spreadsheets is, instead of having my test written in code, I'll write my test in a spreadsheet and then generate the test code from a spreadsheet.
Didn't you employ it this once?
Yeah, I did. And it worked. Again, it was another incremental gain.
Yeah.
So we went from having to have a team of what we could achieve with 12 testers writing code. We had one guy writing the code and everyone else using spreadsheets to write the tests. So, yes, it solved another problem. Again, we went from 50 tests to maybe 150 tests. And for that particular client, we managed to hit out deadlines early and all sort of stuff, but we created another problem. We no longer had to maintain this test code. It wasn't recording playback, but we now had all these spreadsheets that we had to maintain that had the test cases in them.
Mm.
I think there's some commercial products, like Odinax is a commercial product you can buy, which is essentially this sort of approach. It is test spreadsheet generation. So you have your tests.
Okay.
And it has, to try and get around this multiple spreadsheet problem, it has spreadsheets that call other spreadsheets.
Yeah.
Like if you log in one sheet and others will call. So they do steps to try and address some of that. But so that's the next step, right? This is the. How come this is turning into Bruce's history of Tesla?
I have no idea. I'm just sitting by, listening, and enjoying this educational story.
That's the next phase. It's all ways about how can we take this manual effort away? And I think that's the complete wrong way. I think the right way is stop using old languages.
Mm.
So, sorry guys, VBA is dead.
Yeah.
Microsoft killed it and stopped using it like 6 years ago.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Right, and so particularly when I find trying to hire people, you can't hire some young graduate and go, hey, yeah, we did, you know, hey, bright young graduate.
Yeah.
Yes, you're using Ruby and Python and come and do testing in VBA.
Nobody wants to work in these horrible languages. You're never going to hire anybody interested in what they're doing if they're not working in a sexy new language.
So, yes, I'm a C-sharp fan. And part of the reason why I'm so pro C-sharp is Visual Studio is like a drug. Right. People will throw things at me. In my opinion, it's one of the, let's say Ruby or non Microsoft and the QTP people are, the record playback people are already throwing things at me. But that's my opinion in my podcast. If you have another opinion, get your own podcast.
Stop scaring the listeners, Bruce.
Okay, sorry. It's instead, why am I not letting using a really good development environment that's designed to drive productivity writing code?
Mm-hmm.
Why, instead of leveraging that, do you take that act of writing that code and move it across to a spreadsheet? Particularly when you're talking automation of do button, click button, set, push value, you know, verify value, step. You've got exactly the same number of lines in the spreadsheet as you do in the test code. When your test code is click, you know, button dot, you know, is checkbox dot check, drop down list dot do drop down list.
But isn't the idea that it's cheaper and easier to hire people with no coding skills than it is to hire them with coding skills? So if we can somehow get around the problem of having to hire developers as testers, then we'll all just save a lot of money.
But at what cost?
Well, that's just it. It hasn't worked so far.
Do you believe that line you just told me?
I'm just quoting whatever marketing I can see behind the driving factor here. I'm certainly not saying that it's working in any way.
I think that is true. I think one of the thing you're actually you bang on. I think one of the allures of the spreadsheet approach is we can give it to someone who's non-technical. Because non-technical people love Excel.
Yeah, non-technical people are cheap.
And they can write test cases in Excel. So what's the end game here? So we're at the point now where we've gone from having, we now have spreadsheets where we can generate, I'd say in the hundreds maybe, test cases relatively quickly.
Yeah.
Maintenance is still a pain because you've got 50-100 spreadsheets you need to maintain, so you haven't solved the maintenance problem.
No.
But now you don't have to write code.
Mm.
Okay. So the next step is the automation library. So the next step is the I think at this point in my career I was on CompuWare test partner, I think at this point. Silly VBA, is what you would do is you would build some nice big big functions, and you try and pull those sections out of the spreadsheets that you're constantly using. So here's some code to do the login, and here's my code to do the checkbox verification. So you build up this nice suite or framework, and technically it's not really, is it a framework if you only got one project? There's a question about that on Stack and Chain. So we'll call it a library. So you have this library and you build all these functions. So yes, you write code, but you're reducing the amount of code that you write.
Yeah.
Depending on how mature you are or aren't, you may have the same bit of application in multiple functions. So you may, if you've learnt and had some maintenance issues, hopefully you'll get to the point where each particular part of the application is isolated in the one bit of code. So if you get to that level, I would argue that it doesn't matter what tool that's in. If you have your libraries written, so you have each piece of the application is written where you have, here's my one bit of code that does login, and it's the only bit that does login, and there's another bit that does verification of login. If you get to that level, then this whole RSpec BDD languages are very easy to implement them, because you can just do your test case. Amazon example, customize a customer, I want to buy a book.
Yeah.
The next level down is customer, as a customer, I want to buy a book, and then you just grab those three lower level libraries and chuck them in.
Absolutely. It's just adding another layer onto an existing framework. I found the same thing.
So I think with that approach, you can then get to get to your 500 test cases in a 12-month period with a team of six people. So you're incrementally using these approaches, you're getting higher and higher and higher. And then I think to go the next across the lane and further is when you then start writing tools to help and assist with the code generation, as opposed to, look away through the design and productivity of the code of that framework itself. So it's like any development, really. You're talking about a system that's designed and maintained from day one. And so if you look at Visual Studio, has things like, most IDEs have IntelliSense, or people use things like ReSharper. Exactly. Yeah. So you can do three letters and hit tab and you get... So all those sort of tricks you can start to bring to bear to increase your productivity. So for me, that's the reason why you should be looking at these sort of tools and those ways of getting productivity, and you'll get a much bigger gain doing it that way, in my opinion, in my experience, than by the Excel or spreadsheet-based approach or record and play there.
Yeah, absolutely. But I guess it depends on what your goal is, really. I mean, if your goal is that you just want people at the top level to be able to understand your test case, then definitely that's the way to go over any kind of spreadsheets or record or playback or anything like that. If you're just trying to get non-technical people to write your test cases, then I don't know, that's kind of a losing battle in a way. But at the very least, if they're writing test cases in this BDD format and you already have an easy way to automate them, then that's going to save a lot of cost right there.
Yeah. So for me, that is and that's why I find this particular area so exciting, and I'm just a bit frustrated at the moment that I can't use all the current project that I'm on, that I'm working on. And that is that, it's just a national project, but it's really a case of you can finally start to hit both those goals of, I can put my human readable test cases in front of someone, or my non-technical person can write those test cases. So your business analyst or your subject matter expert can write those test cases, and they can just run the automation, and then you can have one or two propeller heads sitting in the corner churning out the automation code. So straight away, you don't have to have everyone being a programmer. So hopefully that answers your earlier point about is it cheaper to hire people that don't know how to code? Well, yes.
Yes.
Have them write this BDD, have them write English,
Exactly.
And give it to you one or two propellers in the corner.
Programs. Well, the collaboration aspect was what drew me to that in the first place, because when we started using that language, I think it was the first time that we'd actually managed to get developers to look at our test cases voluntarily, without actually having to stand behind them and say, for God's sake, just read my bloody test cases and tell me that they're all right. And not only that, we were sitting next to them, they could understand them immediately, and they picked up the language right away, and they were adding more, they were modifying them. I was completely shocked. This had never happened before.
So, because you've tried a few things, haven't you?
To
try and get your, for a better word, your partners at work engaged in testing. Because I suppose one thing which I know we did when we were working at Microsoft as part of our process was we would write our test cases, and then, on paper, we said we had to sit down with our developers and have them do a peer review of the test cases. In my opinion, it didn't happen all that much, but what it did, it added some great value. So you've managed to get a lot more further down the road than we ever did, I think, in that regard.
Well, the thing about my workplace environment is that we don't really have strict processes, so there's no way to really enforce a process. You can't sort of say to somebody, this manager told you to do it this way, so you have to do it that way. We have to tick off this box before this project gets released or anything like that. So whenever we want to take an approach to anybody, we've really got to show them the value in it and make them want to do it in order for them to ever get it done. So, yeah, this was just one method I used to try to get developers to look at our test cases, because before that, when I showed up, having come from that background at Microsoft, I pretty much would just send them a spreadsheet of test cases and say, hey, you have to look at these before I go and test anything and tell me if they're okay. They'd go, sure, all right, I'll do that, and then they wouldn't do it. So, I had to get a bit more creative in my approach.
But to be fair, when we were doing that at Microsoft, when it came to check-in time, when they actually want to get their code promoted, I found out about those test cases at that point.
Yeah, well, that's true. But you kind of knew that if you wanted to, you could probably push someone a bit harder and say, make this guy do what I told them to do, and they'd do it. There's just no way to do that at my company.
Yeah. So it sounds like, what's the word? Bureaucracy or Wild West? Which is better?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you and I work in two very, very
different organizations. We have the polar extremes. Me working in banking and you working for essentially a small startup.
So. Yeah, definitely. So two completely different approaches. I'm listening to the sort of things that you need for your test cases, which are, you need them to be repeatable, for instance. You want to make sure that when two different people run the same test case that they're going to get the same result. My workplace, I'd prefer them to get different results because I don't have that many testers for a start. So if they're running the same test case in two completely different ways, that's actually value to me because it means they're covering slightly more of the system in the time that we have allocated.
Oh, I would never thought like that.
Yeah.
It's very insightful.
Yeah, so in that sense, we don't have that much time or resource to run every single manual test case that we have. So
no one ever has enough time or resource.
Well, that's true, but for us, we've often got maybe one tester per feature, very small amount of time. But for us, if a tiny bug slips through to production, we don't need to get so hung up about it, but with your organisation, it's probably a massive, massive legal issues, etc.
Well, I'm not going to talk about my organisation, but I can talk about the industry in general. Generally, in the financial services industry, they're generally very much a waterfall style. So they're definitely pockets of agile, but normally, the analogy I like to use, it's like, just say for example, I'm in a small town near a small river, and I want to get something down to a market on the ocean. Whilst in my small town on my small little creek, I can do whatever I want. At some point, I have to go on the busy river with all the other boats and play with the rules of all the other boats, and at some point, I have to go down out of the river into the ocean. So that analogy, what I'm saying is you have your own environment, then you go into an integration environment where data is moving from system to system.
Yeah.
Whether it might be from the cards system to, the bank account system or whatever. Or from, I don't know, most of these large organisations are life insurance and, account payable. So this data, they're very much data-centric organisations where data moves from one system to another.
Yeah, sure.
And so what you find is that at some point you have to get in and play that system integration testing game. So you have to do that. I put my data in system A and four systems away down there, someone else will need to verify the results.
Right.
And that also, that's both from a system integration test, as in the other systems just plugging and working. Then it comes down to is the actual user. So the user who's worrying about the end result will be a completely different user, the one that's actually entering the might be a customer who's actually punching something from an ATM machine.
Yeah.
Well, I never actually worked at an ATM machine, but but essentially, my point is that you'll have a front system and a middle, front of office and a middle and a back of office, and the data has to flow through all our systems, and someone somewhere's going to want to see a report, give it goes to a shareholder.
FullView is a boutique design studio that fuses creativity with strategy to create effective graphic design for web and print. To find out more about their work and services, go to www.ful-vue.com.
You have the huge flow of data, and so you have these, so they have to be waterfall, because you have to have all these days where in virtual day one, logical day one, where the person's putting their, is that ATM example, they're making the withdrawal of the ATM. Then on long day two, there'll be an overnight runner, their pay will come in. Then on day three, they will get the letter sent to them telling their credit rating and stuff because they overdrew because their pay hadn't come in. So those, and they're all big process, and each system has a different process and different focus. So you have, in some extent, you can't do that agile. Because you can't. You have to have a plan and have a structure. So the challenge is, how do you act, be agile where you can, but play the we're all on a boat going down the river together?
Yeah.
I think that there's similar sort of challenges when you're building something like Windows.
Yeah, probably.
Because you're going to have, if I'm working, for example, on the internet connection wizard, right? So my wizard is what, three screens on the little notepad or paint, right? It's a very simple thing. So I've got my little paint screen and I'm doing paint. But at some point, it's going to consume some DLLs and has to be deployed as part of Windows. So at some point, I have to get on the Windows bus and put my application into that pile of bits that is going to become Windows. So I assume that the big, big commercial software probably has something similar.
Yeah, sure. I suppose when you've got that kind of flow-on effect, that's things that are impacting other things that you have to integrate with, then you can't really afford to just kind of do everything at once.
So think about something like our Java runtime or the .NET runtime, right?
Yeah.
The .NET runtime now is, I'm not very careful I say because I don't do information, but I'm not sure everything I'm saying is publicly known. And that is that the .NET runtime, it runs on, the Xbox, it runs on, runs on with WPFE, it runs, on phones and Silverlight, right?
Yeah.
So Silverlight runs on Windows Phone 7, it runs on Xboxes, it runs on Macs. So you've obviously, but it also is embedded in SQL Server.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that there is one code base, there may be multiple forks, but at some point, if I'm checking a change into the .NET runtime, it's going to have to go through some regression suite to make sure that my check-in to fix a bug in Windows Phone 7 doesn't break something that's being used in SQL Server.
Yeah, what's that got to do with that agile versus waterfall approach?
So what I'm saying is that whilst I, within my team, am no doubt being agile in the way I'm developing that one feature for Windows Phone 7, I might be working in a Scrum methodology.
Sure.
At some point, that code has to go into some larger waterfall style approach of, I put this feature in and it has to go through that waterfall approach as well. I think that's...
Is that really waterfall though? You're just handing something from one state to another. but that's not necessarily a waterfall approach, right?
True. What is waterfall? So, I suppose, what I'm thinking of is maybe not waterfall, but more of a gated release process.
Right, yeah.
So, I can't just... So, I suppose what I've heard is the extreme of Agile, the ThoughtWorks Agile model, is I can push to production 4 times a day.
Yeah.
So, a developer can check in, and we'll hit production. They can do that 4 times a day. So they can literally check in, boom, check in, then just get pushed right out. That's what I'm saying, the opposite of that, where I might be able to do that at some level in these large organisations or in these large code bases, but there is a slow pipe that needs to go through just because of the checks and balances that have to happen to make sure that when it actually does finally get burnt to a CD or deployed into SQL Server or deployed into a production environment, that all those... All the people that have said yes, it can go, have said yes, it can go.
Yeah, yeah. I know in my organisation, it's certainly not a gated approach at all. It's we kind of have one milestone in each release, which is, can we release it? If the answer is yes, then we release it. I guess that just comes down to it being a... first of all, it's a design-driven approach. So the design will happen first. But by first, I mean that's just what started initially, because development will start soon after that. Testing's involved pretty much right from the start. We'll jump into the design chat room. We use Campfire, which is a chat room software where you can from 37 signals, you can paste in images and things, and they appear in line in the chat, which is really handy for things like design and things.
Yep.
So we'll go in there, we'll comment on the design, the developers will hop in every now and again and give their 2 cents as well. And then as the product's built, the design will change. The developers will think of something they wanted to do differently. The testers, of course, will jump in and go, hey, I'm not sure that this usability is really so good, or I don't know that you've really thought about this feature in the right way or something. So everybody gets to pitch in, give their 2 cents, goes back around to design, and it all sort of happens at once, and then... when it gets to the end, all the tests pass, everybody's happy with it, then it gets released.
So I've got a question for you, because I'm just thinking about from a design point of view.
Mm.
I had a discussion with someone recently, and it was around UI technology.
Mm.
And so I think this particular thing we were talking about was drag and drop in a web UI. And my point of view was that, and what I'm used to, is that with any sort of major UI work, because especially when automation's involved, and I'm thinking more of the view of automation is going to happen but isn't there yet, any change that, maybe not initially, but after a developer has broken all the automation because of some change they've made, there's also an art to make sure automation doesn't break the minor changes. But just say, for example, I'm putting a drag and drop or something that needs right-click or something that's a bit funky that your Seleniums or your Watons don't just... handle straight out of the box. It should be a collaboration as to whether that functionality gets included or, more importantly, how it's implemented. And his point of view was, no. It's tested, I should never say. We'll do what's best for the users and you'll just have to deal with it.
Yeah, well, I agree with him.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't think testing should be involved in the discussion at all?
Oh, I believe testers should be involved in the discussion, but I just believe that you're not designing the product for the testers, you're designing the product for the end users. So if you can't automate it, but the end user really loves it, then what's really the priority there?
I agree with that. What I'm really alluding to is, should test be consulted and have a say in the way design, and more importantly, architecture is done to make something more testable? So,
I think they should be, because if it's possible to do and not completely out of their way to do, then why not? I mean, it's going to make testing easier, and in the end, the return on that is having a more testable product, which ultimately is going to be more stable, or at least easier to verify as more stable, which just benefits everybody.
So, bitch slap 2 with the idea. I agree, but I also play with devil's advocate. My point is, I think, okay, here's a question for you. At what point should test be involved then? Don't give the obvious from day one.
Day one.
Yes.
Yes.
Realistically, at what point should tests? Let's say a web-based, it's really a web-based application. At what point should tests realistically expect to turn up at the table and have their opinion?
Well, realistically, it depends on the organisation, how they're working.
Okay, generally.
Generally.
Okay, no, how long are you?
I can't speak generally.
Don't shut me down with the... We can't talk about that because it... Yeah.
No, we can't talk about it. I'm just saying the reason that it depends is because, well, for instance, you might have an organisation where a lot of the early meetings are... let me think. A lot of the early meetings could be about nutting out a design that has to meet some kind of release gate. So by the time they've finished nutting out the design, even then tests should be involved. So where am I going with that? I don't know.
Were you thinking usability or...?
Well, I was just thinking that often if testers are involved in a really early stage where people decide stuff that isn't... that testers aren't going to make a difference in. Okay, for example, there's maybe some consultants and they're defining some requirements, right? They're consulting with the client. They've negotiated everything they need to get from the client in terms of requirements for their product. A tester being in the room, they know will not make a difference to these negotiations just because of the way that business is working. So maybe there's no value in the tester being there. It's just going to cost you money in that testing resource. It could be doing something else if it's not really going to make a difference anyway. In an organization like mine where they might design requirements in-house because we have complete control over our own product, then a tester being in the room to say, let's think about how we're going to test this, how this might impact other parts of the system, may actually be useful, especially if we can afford to put the tester in the room at the same time.
See, it's interesting that you're bringing up the affordance. I suppose this is because you're very limited in the number of testers you have. My view, and I keep showing this, is I would rather be in a meeting where I don't need to be there than miss a meeting where I should be there and hear something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So what I'm saying is I would happily be dragged along and go, well, why did I sit through an hour of discussion around whether the icon's going to be pink or green? Right?
Yeah.
I'd much rather sit through something like that than, miss a chat on user validation and have them decide that they're going to use some funky pop-up Ajax thing that will add no value. Add no value yet, add a whole heap of technical complexity, and more importantly, let them avoid automation.
Yes.
If they're doing something which is going to impact the quality of the end application. So maybe it's overly complicated, and so, for example, SharePoint.
Yeah.
SharePoint has a role to play as a technology, but time and time again, I see developers drag SharePoint and use it just as a menuing system,
or
just as a place to deploy, to just throw things in, where it's like, okay, yes, these features gives a cool, but realistically, there's all these trade-offs that they haven't considered. Like, for example, everything is now might be framed inside SharePoint as opposed to just building a native .NET application. Again, not very Windows, but it's just an example I can think of where it's a... I think, remember, someone said is that if you let a developer run a project, you'd never ship because there's always some new cool technology that has to be here.
Right, yeah.
If you let a tester control a project, you'd never ship because
it's never good enough.
And if you let a PM, a product or a project manager, or a project manager ship, you would ship yesterday because...
Yeah.
So it's... The real answer is probably in the middle of all three.
Yeah, that's true. And I like the idea of having everybody in that room just to get that sort of balanced perspective all the time. But I guess it's kind of a time cost argument there, really. Like you say, it'd be way better in an ideal world where the tester could just be in every meeting all the time, being able to exactly, and the tester always gets to say, and everybody always listens to them, and that kind of thing. But I guess it just depends on whether that's good use of the tester's time or not, if the tester has limited time.
Yes, yeah, so I suppose one of the key things that I try and do as a test manager is essentially try and deflect and empower the team as much as I can.
Yeah.
So I would waste my time going to all those meetings and try and work out the four or five valuable nuggets of information that the team needs and make sure that they get access to that.
Mm.
So essentially, so it's more wasting the manager's time, and they are, so the rest of the team can then focus on what they need to do.
Yeah.
As opposed to vice versa.
In a large organisation, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, in a small team like mine, I'm the test manager and the tester and the testing.
And frankly, if you can avoid that overhead, you're better off without it.
Yeah.
So I would say in a lot of ways, you're better off with a small team without the need for that overhead.
Yeah. Yeah, that's preferable for sure.
But yeah, that's all funny games. It's as long as I find it.